Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nestler. And that was Buddy Guy describing our Fair Valley today. People rightly rave about Buddy Guy's guitar, but I think he's a strong singer too, and that song certainly exemplifies that. Buddy Guy plays the belly up next Tuesday. Yay! Well, a month ago, I spoke with local photographer Sandy Kaplan. Please enjoy the long version of that conversation today. Sandy Kaplan, welcome to Express Yourself.
Hey, Luke, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I am just great.
I just love all the snow.
Oh, isn't it marvelous?
Do you photograph snow?
I do.
You do?
I do. I go out and photograph skiers.
Oh, I've seen some of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're sort of... It's not typical ski photography.
Let's no,
put
it's
it
not.
That way. It's like blurry bursts of color.
Of color. And none of that is done in Photoshop or anything else. All that's done in the camera. That's actually while I'm shooting. So it's really fun.
Oh, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
So there's, how does that work?
Oh,
that's a secret.
Well, I don't mind sharing. I don't mind sharing. Because I teach, you know, I teach at Colorado Mountain College as well.
Uh-huh.
I teach non-credit clock classes, so my students learn that kind of thing.
And, you know, in your on your website, you mm-hmm. talk about the thrill of teaching, and you say something like, there's nothing like it. And I'm thinking to myself, but this is the woman who photographs spirit bears and statuesque stallions, and that's not as thrilling as teaching?
No.
Why?
It's, okay, I'm not a very religious person. I just have to say that. But I know that I got this gift from God to be able to photograph. I've never gone to photo school. I learned by myself. And it's been a passport for me to go all over the world. So I made this deal. I said, okay, big guy, whoever you are, I'm going to pay it back. I'm going to pay it forward. So anytime anybody ever wants to learn how to photograph, I'm going to teach them. And that's my gratefulness for being able to do this work.
So you didn't make a deal with the devil. You made a deal with God.
Well, whoever he or she happens to be.
Let's call it spirit.
Spirit. A great spirit.
Great spirit.
Yes.
How about that? So what is it that thrills you about passing on your craft and your insights?
First of all, I love to see other people excited, and I love to get people excited. And I've never had a class where I haven't had a couple of people really excited.
Hmm.
It can change your life. It changed my life. It changed my life totally. I've traveled all over the world now, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And it's my camera that's given me the passport.
That's interesting. I've heard teachers many times say that they're not teaching, they're learning.
Always. I always learn from my students.
Huh.
Always. I always learn from everything I photograph. There was a moment in time when I was in Morocco, country dropper, and I was photographing this amazing stallion. It was the most extraordinary stallion. I'm not a horse person. I don't ride, but I love horses. So there was this stallion within 6 inches of me. And I had never seen an animal like this. It was a Lusitano, I believe it's called. And I took my hand and I put it on the top of his head. And I just took my hand all the way down his body, all the way down to his rump. And it was electric. It was absolutely electric. And my whole body just shook. So yes, I learn every time I shoot.
Wow, that's interesting. I'd like to talk about something that I found in your artist statement. I think it was on the Cora Logos website.
Yes.
You say that I don't think about what I'm doing. It's all second nature. It's happening between thoughts or in that space of no thought. When I let go, the photo is made. When I step back and get out of the way, the photo finds itself.
Good for you. That's true.
That's a spiritual practice.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's interesting. I hear artists accomplish in their field many kinds, musicians, mm-hmm. novelists, painters, photographers. They don't all talk about that kind of thing, but many times they do. And I'm thinking that for them and for you, apparently, your art is your practice.
No question. No question. Last night, my husband and I got into a conversation about magical thinking. And I'm a magical thinker. I believe everything is possible. And if you just let it be and relax, one of the classes I teach now is called the Zen of Photography. And I teach the student to stop before they shoot. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you have to just grab the frame. But to stop before you shoot, take a breath, be with that thing, whatever it is that you're shooting, and then get the photo. And you don't take the photo. You make the photo. Taking the photo is just taking a picture of whatever is there. When you make the photo, you really, I mean, I don't want to get too esoteric, but you really do become one with whatever it is you're photographing. Mm-hmm. And that makes the difference. My photos are not always in focus. They're not always technically perfect, but I get the soul of whatever it is I'm shooting.
One of the things that occurred to me when I read that was that you have to have a base of craft behind you to allow yourself to not think when you're pressing that shutter. Is that right?
Did you happen to watch the Olympics last night and the ice dancing?
No.
The ice dancing last night was amazing. I mean, there were all these people and they all deserved a gold medal. They've all worked since they were little tiny kids. They have all the technology, all the technique, all the learning, all the muscle memory, and then they get on the ice and they don't think. You watch the snowboarders. They put on music. They're not thinking about what they're doing. They're being with what they're doing. And that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. Because they've trained themselves
because they
to
trained.
Reach that
Absolutely,
point.
Yeah. Oh. So I started shooting in the 60s. Just let my age go. And I've worked hard to learn what I know already, and I don't know anything. There's so much to learn in this craft. But you do everything you need to do to learn what you need to learn, and then you take a picture.
You started in portraits, right?
Well, I started doing anything I get paid for. And so I was in Hollywood. And so I was working in the motion picture industry, photographing movie stars and that kind of thing. So they were portraits, they were headshots, and all kinds of things. And it's, again, Gordon and I were talking this morning, and I was saying how difficult it is for me specifically to get in a gallery that really understands me, because I don't want to be a photographer that shoots horses or that shoots bears or that shoots barns. I want to be a photographer that makes art. Doesn't matter what the subject matter is. Doesn't matter if it's Henry Fonda, or there goes my age again, or Justin Bieber, or a horse. It's all the same thing.
And so when you're making art, what is it that you're making? Are you evoking a feeling? Is that what you're doing when you're making?
I have no idea. That's where that comes in, where you just step away and let it happen.
Huh. You spent a long time in the fashion world.
I did.
And I read on your website that you photographed in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's a long way from Paris to an island in British Columbia photographing spirit bears.
Well, I lived in Redstone for 20 years. How's that?
Oh, okay. So that's what did it. It was Redstone.
Well, Redstone was after all of that.
Oh.
I was born in Chicago, raised in California, raised in Hollywood, and loved it. I loved it. I wanted to be a fashion designer. And turns out I became a photographer who shot fashion. And I loved it, I think, more than any other shooting I've done. I don't know. I love it all. But maybe that's my favorite.
Huh.
It's when I was a little girl, I used to play with paper dolls. And I would dress them up, and then I had regular dolls, and I would make clothes and fix their hair. And that was the ultimate. Shooting fashion was the ultimate playing with dolls.
Interesting. You know, I've never gotten fashion, but you're talking to a guy that wears sweatpants, and that's basically it. I have a dress tie-dye. Let's put it that way. But I get that I don't know. Explain fashion to me.
Fantasy.
Fantasy.
Fantasy. That's all it is. It's fantasy. Think about it. You look at those photographs. I'm diametrically opposed. I will say this right now. I'm diametrically opposed to what the fashion industry has done to women and to models. I hate it.
Objectified them?
Objectified them, but I was at a horse shoot a long time ago, 4 years ago or so, and this woman came up to me. And she was quite attractive, normal-looking woman, but attractive. And she just tore me apart. And she said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I went, no. And she said, "Well, I was one of your models back in Hollywood. And I used to have to sit in the corner and eat a chocolate bar, eat a piece of a chocolate bar, because I hadn't eaten in 4 days so I could fit into your darn clothes." She really let me have it. And there are girls dying all over the world right now trying to fit in to the fashion world. That's the part of it I really, really hate. Mm. The creative part, the wonderful part, the things that people do with a piece of fabric, the feeling it evokes, is wonderful.
Is that what eventually drove you to landscape and wildlife photography?
No, my life has taken so many turns. It's taken so many turns. I was in Paris for 5 years and starved and loved it. It was difficult and it was fun and I really, really enjoyed it. But it was time to leave. I went back to the States and opened my studio in Los Angeles and was there for 8 years and did very well, loved it. Shot a lot of different things, a lot of advertising, things like that, a lot of fashion, and then dropped out of life for several years and put down my camera for 25 years.
You did?
Yes. Yes, I put down my camera for 25 years. I went to massage school. I became a healer, and I did that for a very, very long time. In between, I lived in communes and wore beads and robes and danced around and found myself. And then one day in Redstone, a girlfriend of mine, a very dear friend, said, "You've got to get back to shooting." And she bought me my first little Sony point-and-shoot. And it was my first digital camera. Oh, boy, was I scared. And after about 3 months of playing with that, I called Nikon and I bought my first Nikon. And it sat on my dining room table for 3 months before I had the courage to open the box. And then I started learning how to use a digital camera.
All in good time, I guess.
All in good time.
A time to every purpose kind
right.
of thing. Huh. So, and that was 20 years ago?
That was maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Tell me about spirit bears.
Wow.
What are they?
Wow. A spirit bear is the actual name for it is a Kermode bear, K-E-R-M-O-D-E, Kermode bear. And they're a very rare bear. It's a subspecies of a black bear, but it is not a black bear. It is not an albino. It has pigmentation. It has incredible brown eyes. When they give birth, they give birth to both black bears and white bears. You never know when a sow is going to give birth what she's going to have. There are only between 200 and 400 of them left in the world now. They're not on the endangered species list, which is something I don't understand because they are. And they're extraordinary. And to be with them is absolutely magical.
Why? How?
They have a personality I've never witnessed before. I've seen bears here. I don't know if you remember, but up in Redstone, we had Tripod. Tripod was a little cub that had broken his leg. And I was there, actually, the moment he broke his leg. Mm-hmm. And I ran and called the Forest Service, and the Forest Service said, "Don't do anything. He'll either make it or he won't." And he did end up making it, and he became kind of the bear of Redstone. and he would hobble around on three legs. And he was sweet, and he had a darling personality. He used to come and sit in my yard all the time. The spirit bears, they're called spirit bears for a reason. They go back thousands of years. And when you talk to the Indians, the First Nation people up in British Columbia, the First Nation people are the caretakers of the bears. And their stories go back, way back, generations and generations back, to where they first found them. So they've always been the keepers of the bears. And they're very spiritual to their beliefs. When you go in the longhouses and the lodges and you see the paintings on the walls, you'll see turtles and dolphins and whales and birds, and there'll always be a spirit bear there. And the spirit bear is the only white object in the paintings. They're just extraordinary. They're so special. When you see them, you know. Now, when I went, I was really privileged to be with an amazing woman. Her name is Jody, and Jody Willard is an extraordinary photographer. And she had two other women with her, so there were just the four women. We, of course, had guides. You can't go into the Great Bear Forest without guides, and the guides are the First Nation people. And there were some other people on the river, and other people were not getting the bears. And every morning we would go there, and we would take some sage, and we would rub the sage in our hands, and we would hold hands, and we would thank Mother Nature for letting us be there, and we would thank the bears for allowing us to be there. And usually within 2 or 3 minutes, we had white bears all over the place. Hmm. And the other people up and down the river never had the bears.
Hmm. So they didn't have the spirit.
They didn't have the spirit. You have to have the spirit to have the spirit bears. We had bears literally. There was one point at which I was sitting on a ledge with my legs dangling in the river. And the black bear came across the river and started sniffing at my foot. And the guide came over to me and very quietly said, don't move. And I said, I'm not moving, but I think I just peed my pants. It was amazing. There was one day when one of the white spirit bears came across the river and got as close as I am to you, at which time the guide came in between us and just looked at this bear and said, good bear, nice bear, go away, bear. And the bear just looked at her and turned around and walked away. Now, you can't do this except in September. September is where the bears are feeding in order to hibernate. If you go in there when they have cubs, you can't do that kind of stuff. You can't do that kind of stuff any other time. And I certainly couldn't have done it by myself. These guides have been raised with the bears. Our guide was just incredible. Jolene was an amazing woman. And Jolene Robertson, and she's, wow. And she's been going into the Great Bear Forest since she was 5 years old. So these people are raised with these bears. I don't even know what to say. The hardest thing for me was not to scream with joy when I saw them, because your whole body just starts to shake. You get so excited, and they're so close to you.
That's not a good thing if you're trying to press a shutter.
No, it's not.
So how do you approach them for photography purposes? Do you
carefully.
Sit there for a long, long time?
Long time. Long time. You sit there for a very long time. I'll tell you how much adrenaline is going through your body. The first day getting on the boat, just before I went down the ramp, I caught my boot on the top of a concrete stair, only it wasn't a stair, it was a big pallet. And I had a 22-pound pack on my back, all my camera equipment, and tripped and fell flat on my face. Broke my nose, cracked both my kneecaps and my patella. And I started screaming, I broke my nose. So I brought up my hand and I reset my nose. And I took about 10 minutes and everybody's yelling, you know, we'll get a plane in here. We'll fly you back to Vancouver because there's nothing there. You're just on an island. And I said, just give me a minute. So I took a few minutes and I got up and I said, okay, let's go. And they said, you can't go. And I said, yes, I can. The adrenaline, just knowing I was going to be there, and then the adrenaline with being with those bears for 5 days. I lived on Advil. I came home. That was it. I was not going to give up the opportunity to be with those bears. That's the kind of a rush you get.
Huh. Have you gotten such a rush from other subjects? It sounds like maybe that Moroccan horse, that statuesque stallion.
That, and if you look at the back of my card right over there, that's a herd of wild horses that I was photographing. And as you can see, I'm standing right in front of them. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when you're shooting animals, which I just learned how to do, I just started photographing animals 4 years ago. That was my very first shoot up in Craig. And that's a whole different thing because you have to be constantly ready for the unexpected to happen because it's going to.
You're known for printing on handmade paper. I know that this one is one of those. You can't really tell that from looking at your card, but did you do that with the spirit bears too, or is that?
I haven't done it yet with the spirit bears. I have yes, I do. I have a couple of different surfaces that I'm going to be using for some of the spirit bears because they talk to me. They talk to me. There's one piece I'm really wanting to print on a plank of wood. They're from the forest. The paper that I get, I'm very proud of that. The paper that I get, I try to get from women's collectives around the world.
Oh.
So I support people. I support women working around the world. It's hard to find, but I do what I can to find it. And it's really exciting. I finally found a paper company in Los Angeles that can get me some sheets.
You mean big sheets?
Big sheets. I just paid $180 per sheet for 2 sheets of paper.
Huh.
And I haven't used them yet. They're very large. I think there's one piece that's about 6 feet by 4 feet. And I'm dying to use that. I'm just waiting for the right subject.
How do you print on handmade paper?
Carefully.
I mean, tell me a little, what's the technique?
I use a digital drum printer. I use an HP Z3100, which is an older printer now. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be looking to buy a new one because this one, it's less expensive to buy a new one than it is to fix the old one. Unfortunately, technology, I hate that about it. But the reason I had to buy 2 sheets of paper is that I'm going to have to cut one of them up just so I can do my tests on it. in order to use that one sheet properly. It's very laborious work. It's scary work.
So you have to pass it through the drum several times?
No, you pass it once.
Just once.
Just once. The inks on that particular printer are $100 an ink, and so you use 12 different kinds of inks. It's $1,200 every time you have to change the ink. That particular printer, which I really love, I hate to give it up, has 12 heads. Normally, a printer has many, many less. So if you, the papers also have texture on it. So if you break a head, you have to replace all the heads. On this particular printer, you can replace each head separately.
So are these heads in contact with the paper or are they shooting the ink?
The word gicle, which now they call printing on canvas gicles. Gicle is actually a French word, and it comes from a process which was really the first airbrush. And there was a big bulb full of air, and the printer or the painter would touch the bulb with his foot, press it down, and the air would come up from a tube, and it would be a little ink well, and it would blow the ink onto whatever surface they were using. Well, when you're using these new printers, they kind of do the same thing, only you don't have to press the little bulb. They blow the colors onto the paper. That's the way the printers work. And the better printer, the better the print. It's an extraordinary process.
Huh. And the skill comes from how you pass the paper through the printer? Or where is your skill? Where does that come in?
The skill comes with feeding the printer the proper information, which means you have to give the printer the best print you can come up with, or the best image you can come up with. At the best, the more dots per inch, the more DPIs, the better the printing is going to be, the better resolution. And you have to calibrate your computer with the printer. I so long for the darkroom. I can't tell you. I so long for film. It's so much easier.
What's stopping you?
Space and time and money. I have my old darkroom. It's sitting in the closet at my house. I have no space for it.
What do you miss about the darkroom?
The magic. It was magic. You walk into this dark room, and I'm a television freak. So I always had a television with a safety film over the front of it so I could watch TV while I was working. And that was my safe light in my dark room. And you would take this sheet of paper and you would put it in this liquid, and magically, this image would appear. And you would wait for just the right moment to take it out. And then you put it in the stop bath. And then you watch it stop its action. And then you put that into the wash. And you come out and you have this image. Now, this was the fun part. When we finally dismantled my studio, we took the pipes out of the dark room and we sold them, because they were completely coated in silver because of the silver salts coming off of the paper. It was exciting. And the silver salts coming off of the film, because you would have to process the film. It was so magic. Huh. It was so magic.
Kind of toxic, though.
Very toxic.
Yeah.
My hair fell out once.
Because of the darkroom?
Yes. I used to shoot the McDonald's parade. There were 102 musicians from all around the country, two kids from each state, and they would march in the Rose Bowl parade. And it was my job every year to photograph those kids when they arrived and when they were here or when they were in Los Angeles during all kinds of festivities, and then get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, get to the parade by 5, and walk the entire parade photographing these kids. It was great fun. They were wonderful. And then every night, I would have to rush back to my studio, process the film, get everything print, deliver the prints in the morning when I started my work. So I did that for 5 days. Well, on the last day, which was the party, I wanted to look nice. So I put my hair up on hot rollers. But my hair was caked with chemicals. And when I took the hot rollers out, all my hair fell out.
Oh, no. So you started a new look.
A new look, yes. Before punk was in, I was punk.
Oh, how about that? And all because of the Tournament of Roses.
All because of the Tournament of Roses and McDonald's.
How about that?
I love my work.
You must.
I do. I do.
What do you love about it? Why do you love it?
Everything. Everything about it. I can't even tell you. I'm married now. I've only been married for 4 years. And when I wasn't married, when I was single, I would work all night long. I would work days at a stretch. I wouldn't get out of my pajamas for a week just working. I love every part of it.
You must be full of stories.
I am.
I bet.
Full of other stuff, too.
I don't believe it for a second. Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's local photographer Sandy Kaplan. You can see her work at Sandra Lee Kaplan, that's with a K, photography.com. Wyoming author C.J. Box has published 17 Joe Pickett novels since 2001. With very sympathetic characters, taut plots, plausible villains and lucid descriptions of his native state. Each book has outsold any previous one, adding up to more than 10 million copies altogether. Mr. Box has a new Joe Pickett novel to be released next week called The Disappeared. I spoke with C.J. Box yesterday as he wraps up the publicity tour for his new book. C.J. Box, welcome to KD&K.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're very much welcome. And I'm very excited, as are millions of others around the world, that there is a new Joe Pickett novel slated to drop next week. It's the 18th one, and it's called The Disappeared. Tell me about The Disappeared.
Well, in this book, Joe Pickett is a Wyoming game warden based in the Bighorns. And in this book, the new governor of Wyoming drops in on Joe and asks him to do a mission on his behalf, and that's to travel all the way across the state south to the upper North Platte River Valley around Saratoga to investigate the disappearance of a wealthy British woman ad executive who's left a dude ranch after her stay and then never returned back to England. And it's become somewhat of a big issue in the tabloid press over there. And Joe sent down there because he's a game warden and can kind of integrate himself into the community to try to find out what happened to her.
Well, your tail hangs on that for sure. A lot of your books are known for bringing or framing the story around a hot-button issue or topic. What's the one involved in this book?
Well, there's a couple of things going on. One is kind of an exploration of the dude ranch industry and that kind of tourism in the Mountain West, where wealthy people from celebrities, politicians from this country and also internationally come to spend a week or so on a dude ranch and play cowboy for a week, and how that kind of juxtaposition of Old West and New West comes together. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is that Joe Pickett's buddy, Nate Romanowski, who is the outlaw falconer who packs a very large handgun, asks Joe to look into the fact that fellow falconers like him who have eagle permits to hunt with eagles are being denied those permits from the Fish and Wildlife Service. And Nate would like Joe to try to figure out what's going on and why they no longer have access to those birds.
Oh, okay. So I guess Wyoming is a little bit behind the curve of Colorado in terms of being invaded by the wealthy. I was a little surprised to discover the extent to which that is happening up there. Evidently, that's a real issue now, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, dude ranches have been around for hundreds of years. One thing that's kind of new in that business is the super luxury resort-type dude ranch. And I spent some time on one of them talking to the management and then talking to some of the guests to kind of get a handle on that. And I just find it fascinating that people who are, you know, really in the fast lane wherever they live, always connected online, always on their phones, consider a week away from all of that being totally unplugged as like a perfect vacation. I think in the past, dude ranches used to have a whole different kind of marketing message when that went out. Now it's like, come here and get away from the rest of the world for a week.
Huh. How about that? So well, Jackson has seen that for decades, but you said you said this one in Saratoga, the southern part of the state, probably a part of the state that a lot of people don't know about. Describe the Sierra Madre Mountains and the Snowy Range and where you've set your book.
Right. It's in the upper North Platte Valley. It's an area that isn't as well known, like you say, but is also really frequented by extremely wealthy people. There's several big dude ranches here, as well as some resort-type clubs that people fly their jets into. But it's not a mass tourism destination by any means.
Until this book comes out.
Well, we'll see.
Well, I understand that the Wolf Hotel has a room called the Joe Pickett Room.
They do now, yeah. When I write about a specific area, sometimes I have fictional towns and fictional locations. But when Joe Pickett moves, whether he goes to Yellowstone Park or Jackson Hole or, in this case, Saratoga, I try to do that as accurately as I can. And in this book, when Joe Pickett arrives in Saratoga, he gets a room at the Wolf Hotel, room number 9, which is really up there. And the owners of the hotel have now called that the Joe Pickett Room.
How about that? Well, I understand that's familiar territory to you. Your first job out of college was as a reporter at the Saratoga Sun.
That's right. And I really fell in love with the area. And my wife and I bought a small little ranch near here and really enjoy it. It's kind of different to write about things right out the window. But everybody was very cooperative, and everybody in town seems to enjoy the fact that this one is going to feature the area as it is, and naming real names, and we'll see if people actually do show up as a result. I don't know.
Well, they won't stay, though, because of your winters, I guess.
That's right. It all takes place during a very brutal January in Wyoming.
Well, in fact, you have a couple of really fine descriptions of the cold. One of them was, it was so cold it took you by surprise, which is great.
Yeah.
And the other one was, the cold pinched your skin between its fingers and gave it a sharp twist.
Well, yeah, and that's what it feels like when it's 20 or 30 below and you step outside, yeah.
Well, now, we're suffering through one of our warmest and least snowy winters in ages, maybe ever. Is it the same up in Wyoming this year?
It depends where. In and around Saratoga, the snowpack's about 90%, but everybody would like it to be a little higher. And
sure,
there hasn't been as much snow, in the lower elevations as usual.
I read, CJ, that you are a native of Casper and that you, as a boy, made frequent trips to the public library and you were taken in by those librarians who passed you a lot of books to read. One of the series that you read as a kid was one that I read, too, Encyclopedia Brown. I hadn't thought
That's
of Encyclopedia
right.
Brown.
I suppose those books still exist out there, but at the time... Yeah, I was really into those. I think it's probably the first series I ever read, and that's when I kind of discovered how great libraries can be. And the librarians did what they called interlibrary search or something. So they made sure that I could obtain and read all of those books.
Huh.
And then when I was done with that series, they would kind of challenge me with more sophisticated reading and. I learned probably more in the library than I ever did in school.
Yeah, well, that's impressive. That's really great. You know, you're just a couple years younger than I am, and so that series had a lot of meaning for me, too. One of the important things about that for me was that it demonstrated that you could be smart, and that was kind of cool to see somebody that you could respect who's smart.
Right, and he's just a regular kid, but has a lot of determination and really puzzles things out in pretty clever ways.
Uh-huh. Well, another person who thinks for himself is your hero, and Joe Pickett, of course, is who I'm talking about. 40 years ago for me, it was all about the Grateful Dead, and now I read detective novels and watch the NFL, and I joke with my mother about that all the time. She's a Wyoming native. In fact, she was also born in Casper. And,
interesting.
Yeah. And so she loves Joe Pickett. So here's an 86-year-old woman and, an old hippie who loved Joe Pickett. And I'm trying to figure out why that is. What's your take on that?
Boy, I don't really know. I never set out strategically to try to figure out how to do this. But I think it's a couple of things. I think the setting is important. I hear from readers all the time that they enjoy the kind of exotic Wyoming setting and the outdoor nature of the books on the one hand. But also I think Joe himself is just kind of a normal guy. He's not a Superman. He has his probably best quality or most important quality is that when he gets involved in some kind of case or investigation, he will follow it through to the end no matter what. But also, I think readers tend to like his family. Unlike a detective series or sort of PI kind of thing, private investigator. Joe's married. He has three daughters that he dotes on, and they're an important part of every book. So I think he just kind of comes across as maybe a little more realistic than some of the heroes out there.
Well, it's interesting to me that his family and Joe, they're so sympathetic, and they obviously love each other to death. And I'm curious to know how a man can draw out and flesh out female characters so well. How are you able to do that?
Boy, that's a good question. I think probably, in my own family, we have three daughters.
Oh.
And they're always talking, so I'm always listening to them.
Okay.
But they're also my first readers now. Whenever I get a manuscript done, it goes to all three daughters and my wife and my female agent. So they set me right if I've got wrong perspective or have a female character maybe thinking away or saying something that a female would maybe be less likely to say. But mainly I think I just kind of treat my female characters as human beings and don't try to sexualize them and make them real people and sympathetic people, I hope.
Well, Joe Pickett's wife, Mary Beth, is a true partner, and she has been since the very beginning of the series. She's smarter
right.
than Joe, and the cool thing is that Joe knows that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what that's like. my wife's kind of the same way.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, she has been very, very involved in the case. She's kind of serves as his researcher and background information, and because she works in a library, has access to all sorts of information that she uses to help him when he's out in the field investigating something.
And I'm charmed by the fact that whenever Joe is out in the field working for the governor, whichever governor it is, he calls her just about every day just to kind of update her, and he sort of uses her as a sounding board for his theories, doesn't he?
That's right, and she is very smart, as is his three daughters.
Huh. Well, let's talk about the three daughters. Sheridan is the oldest, and she figures prominently in this new book, The Disappeared. I don't want to spoil anything about it, but, she's growing up, isn't she, Sheridan?
Right, and she has taken a job after graduating from college, taken a job as a wrangler on the Silver Creek ranch, on the exclusive dude ranch. So because of what she does, she's able to offer a lot of insight into the ranch operations, into the guest relations, and into the particular woman who has gone missing. So she's very much kind of in step with Joe on an investigation and turns out to be pretty useful.
And I think it's fair to say Joe, I don't know if sympathizes is the word, but he resonates the most with his oldest daughter, doesn't he?
Right. They've got a very close relationship because she grew up going on ride-alongs with him out in the field and kind of knows what he does and how he operates.
Uh-huh. One of the cool things about your series, your Joe Pickett series, is that they're aging in real time. And I think that's real key to the appeal of the series. And so now Sheridan is graduated from college. She has her first serious romance in this book. And, of course, that's a little perplexing to Joe, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, he's never really dealt with his daughter as an adult before.
Uh-huh.
And so she's in a different setting and, like you said, has this romance that he's kind of suspicious of. But so it's they're both adults now, and he's finding that a little more difficult than probably she is.
And Sheridan, though, is, I think, pleasantly surprised at the fact that her father is now treating her as a grown-up. And there's a little passage in there that just rings true for me because I have a 25-year-old son. And, I love where we're at now, the two of us, because we have deep conversations about this and that. And I sense that it's the same dynamic between Joe and Sheridan.
I think it is, and there's several scenes where that occurs.
Yeah. Another of the daughters, Joe's daughters, that has figured prominently in several of your books is April. She's not much of a presence in this new book, but she has figured prominently in some of my favorites of the Joe Pickett series. But you know, I'm kind of go ahead.
She's kind of the wild one. Yeah,
she is a wild one. And but, you know, it's funny. And correct me if I'm wrong. I sort of read blurbs of all the books because I didn't read them in order, which maybe is a mistake. But I've read every one of the Joe Pickett novels. And I can't recall any of the novels that features Lucy. Are there plans?
You know what? I'm kind of correcting that with the next book because I'm 200 pages in, and Lucy is much more prominent in the book that will come out next year than she has been in previous ones.
Oh, that's good news. The other thing, I was looking at a map of Wyoming this morning and trying to remember where you set various of your books. One of my favorites was set in the Red Desert, the southwest corner of Wyoming. And then, of course, a lot of them are centered in the Bighorn Mountains, which are,
right,
I think, probably, well, you can't say. There's so many beautiful ranges in Wyoming. But, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I don't recall any of these novels being set in the Wind Rivers. And to my mind, the Wind River Mountains are the spiritual center of your state.
Oh, I love the Wind Rivers. When I was talking about it being sometimes using fictional settings, the book Nowhere to Run, the idea from that book of the two brothers who are up in the wilderness on their own, who encountered Joe Pickett, comes from a story that actually happened in the Wind Rivers. I just changed the location of it to another part of the state. But uh-huh. I agree with you that it would be a good idea, and I will in the future, uh-huh, set something more in the Wind Rivers, probably around Pinedale or Lander.
Okay. Well, you know, you mentioned earlier that the fact that the land plays such an important part in this series of books, it reminds me a little bit of Tony Hillerman. I would say that your books and Tony Hillerman's books are really the only detective thrillers that I've really gotten into. And I realize that part of the reason is because both of them are so set in their setting. It's a big part of every story, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and that's a high compliment because Tony Hillerman was kind of the pioneer in this kind of genre about, you know, a rural Western setting and really mining it for the realism of it. And so, thank you. But yes, the terrain, the atmosphere, the feeling, the light are really important. And because these are outdoor books, they're described, but hopefully not too long in detail so that people get bored with it.
You know, I'm curious why you made Joe Pickett a game warden and not a cowboy or a politician or a mechanic. Why game warden?
Well, from the very first book, Open Season, I was never intending to write a series. I was writing a book about, in my mind, a contemporary issue, and that's the Endangered Species Act and how, you know, well-meaning legislation sometimes goes awry on the ground where it takes place. And that was the issue I wanted to write about with the first one, kind of based on the black-footed ferrets of Wyoming. And when I was writing it, at first the protagonist was going to be a sheriff and then a journalist, but it made the most sense to have the protagonist be a game warden who would be really involved with that issue. So that's why it was a game warden. He would be involved in, you know, endangered species and being out in the field and dealing with landowners. And then when the publisher bought the book and wanted two more with Joe Pickett, then the series was born.
Well, he's a remarkably sympathetic character, as I said earlier. And another one, despite his, I don't know if flaws is the word, but, you know, Nate Romanowski, you've described Nate as the scariest, most admirable guy ever. Tell our listeners about Nate Romanowski, who makes a big appearance in this new book.
He does. Nate Romanowski is a an outlaw falconer who has a special forces background and carries one of the largest handguns available, and has got his own kind of sense of justice and sense of pace. And he's been with Joe on and off since the third book, and he shows up in this one with his issue. He's trying to go straight in a way and re-enter civilization from some earlier books, but he still has some of those episodes that occur where he lashes out, and it happens a couple of times in this book.
Yes, it does, although he didn't tear any ears off this time.
No, but there's a scene in a fish hatchery that's one of my favorites.
I guess we won't go further than that. That might be a spoiler, but it is pretty funny. There's no doubt about that. Well, what's next? You know, I guess we could talk a little about the standalone books, but I don't think that's necessarily a focus now because your new book is not a standalone book. But you don't just write Joe Pickett novels, do you?
That's right. I've got 5 standalones, working on another one. They tend to come out every other year, and they generally take place outside of Wyoming. And they're a little darker, generally, and I get to try some different things as a writer and try some different techniques that hopefully will make the series better, too. But there are some people who have read all the standalones and none of the Joe Pickett books. So I know that there's certainly a readership out there for those, and they're fun as well. But the next one will be another Joe Pickett book coming out next March.
Well, that's cool. I think I read somewhere that 3 of your favorite, I almost said albums, books, is are Open Season, Blue Heaven, and Badlands. And 2 of those 3 are standalone novels, aren't they?
Right. And with the standalone, too, you know, you have to reinvent a whole new world each time. So they tend to be a little more unique in my mind sometimes than the Joe Pickett ones that have the same characters and located in the same area.
Huh. Is it hard to keep Joe Pickett and Nate and Mary Beth and the family fresh every story?
I think, yeah, it's a challenge, but by the fact that they do age in real time kind of changes it up and makes it a kind of a fresh palette each time.
Well, CJ Box, I want to thank you for engaging millions of readers in a series that at first glance doesn't hold out a lot of promise compared to some, but you get into it and it's like, this is the best stuff ever. So I just want to thank you for creating characters and stories that resonate across the age spectrum and across genders, you know, all of it. It's pretty universally acclaimed, isn't it? And I know that because, as I said earlier, my mother loves it, my son reads you, I read you. It's pretty cool that you managed to bring in a lot of people into your circle.
Well, it's really my pleasure, and thank you very much.
The Disappeared receives its official release next Tuesday, and according to the Garfield County Library's website, there is 1 copy available and 26 people are on the wait list already for the book. You can learn more about this popular and prolific author at cjbox.net. That's going to do it for Express Yourself. Thank you for tuning in. This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. Support for KDNK comes from Bighorn Toyota. Family owned and operated with fully certified sales and service, Bighorn is where locals buy Toyotas. 945-6544, bighorntoyota.com. Call now and pledge your support to KDNK. Do what Nancy and Greg Watts did. They renewed their membership. Call us now. We have people to answer those phones. Pledge your support to your community radio station. Thanks for listening. Please remember to go out there and express yourself.